Hello, this is Ken Kroll from WXPR Public Radio, your moderator for the next hour for a program exploring a medical condition that is having a growing impact here in the North Woods and across the country. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. More than 5 million people have Alzheimer's disease. One in three will die of the disease or some other dementia. Last year, there were more than $200 billion in unpaid care provided by more than 15 million people. This year, it will cost more than $200 billion to care for Alzheimer's patients. By 2050, that cost will be five times that. Those are some of the facts from the Alzheimer's Association website. Today, we have a panel to talk about this issue. We'll burrow deeper into some of the numbers I provided and find out how the North Woods is doing. Joining me today is Dr. Chris Kempel, Northern Wisconsin Memory Diagnostic Center Director. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ken. Thanks.
And also with us is Julie St. Pierre, Outreach Specialist for the Alzheimer's Association Greater Wisconsin Chapter. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
And also we have a recent caregiver with us, Jim Brust. Hi, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Kempel, let's begin, I guess. Let's first talk about the Northern Wisconsin Memory Diagnostic Center. You know, describe what it is, where it is, and how it works.
Certainly. In fact, it's timely that you bring that up because as Julie and I were talking before tonight, this is the 15th year that the Memory Diagnostic Center has been in existence. It started in 1998 as an outreach of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I met with Dr. Mark Sager, who is the director down there of their program in their geriatric department. They had a program there at UW, but the idea was we needed to try and expand this ability to form a clinic that could work specifically with elderly patients who may have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, identify it early, try and do what was necessary to diagnose it, realizing that the process of diagnosing is complex, not something that fits into a typical doctor's office visit, the 15 or 20 minute visit in the office, and that we wanted to try and expand this outside of the larger city arena. So we got together and we organized a group. We started that clinic here in Rhinelander in 1998, which is made up of myself, a nurse practitioner, an Alzheimer's Association representative, happening to be Julie now, as well as a social worker and a psychologist. And that's kind of the nucleus of the team. We're all employed mostly by ministry medical group, and then Julie with the Alzheimer's Association, which I like because it's a merging of the traditional medical model and the public health, or in this case, the Alzheimer's Association agency, an agency in the community, so that we're sort of working together to try and bring together the various levels of expertise at that clinic. We meet 2 half-days a month, which is as much as we can do and have been doing all these years. And actually, for 15 years now, doing it 2 afternoons a month, we have seen over 1,000 new patients in Rhinelander alone. And the patients have come from our area, but they've come from as far away as the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, as far away as the western part of the state. When we started, of course, we were the only clinic in northern Wisconsin, in fact, the only clinic outside of Madison in Wisconsin. Now there are over 40 clinics in our consortium scattered across the state of Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is unique in that we are the only state in the country that has this memory diagnostic clinic network. There is no other state in the country that has this. We are looked upon around the country as sort of a model for this this type of work. One of the, besides being able to provide early diagnosis, there are patients who are involved in research, children of patients that are involved in research at UW-Madison. Again, a unique element across the country. So there's lots of really interesting and important things that have grown out of our memory diagnostic network. So that's a little background.
And it's here, right in Rhinelander.
It's in Rhinelander. It's located over at Ministry Medical Group on our campus. Appointments can be made by just directly calling the clinic. We have a number. Sometimes patients are referred from their physician or their nurse practitioner or their provider. Other times they have been referred directly by patients being aware of our clinic. People might be wondering as they're listening to this, boy, I haven't heard a lot about the clinic. One of the reasons for that is that because we can only offer 2 half-days a month of services, we haven't advertised the clinic vigorously, I guess I would say, in the newspapers, because we want to be able to handle the patient volume that we have, which is mostly from the referrals internally at this point and some that are external. We look to trying to expand this, but one of the challenges is trying to pull together this level of expertise from a variety of resources in one setting, and it's hard to do that more than a certain number of days a month. In fact, even at UW, I think they have one day every 10 days or so that they do this, and that's as much as they can do with all the other demands on the various professionals.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up a bit and describe the disease itself. What is it?
Well, dementia, which I like to first start by saying, what is dementia? Dementia is loss of cognitive function, usually more than just memory. We think of memory, everybody thinks that somebody has memory loss, they may have dementia. Memory loss is a cardinal feature of Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common form of dementia. But there are other forms of dementia, things like vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia. We use names like that that involve a slight different type of dementia. In some instances, memory loss may be only a minor part. What are the other cognitive deficiencies that we see with dementia? They can be behavioral changes. They can be trouble with language, and inability to use certain words. It can be things where individuals can't remember how to do something that they always knew how to do. So, for example, buttoning a shirt or putting on a pair of shoes. So those are examples of the sort of neurological and cognitive components together. Being disoriented or not knowing what day it is, not knowing how to process certain tasks, driving as an example. So there, it's not just memory loss, it's these other elements too. And when more than two or more of them come together in a person, that's usually an indication that a form of dementia then is developing. And Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, making up 70% of the cases we see in our region and in the country, the most common form of dementia in older patients, meaning patients as they age. You alluded a little bit to the statistics, but about 10% of people over the age of 65 will have some form of dementia, even if it's early, and 50% of people over the age of 85 will have some degree of dementia, usually Alzheimer's disease at the age. Again, it can be a mild form or a more severe form. So the disease of dementia and Alzheimer's is a cognitive disorder, loss of cognitive function, but also loss of some of these other capabilities that people have in terms of day-to-day living.
I think a lot of people, you know, they maybe have a memory lapse or something during the day, and they get concerned right away. How can somebody self-diagnose? I guess you shouldn't do that, but I mean, how can they?
Sure.
How do they know?
Well, so that's the issue of what's normal for aging and what isn't, and this comes up all the time. And you're exactly right. We all have our little lapses. Probably the common things that occur with aging that we all have and that are not necessarily dementia is first and foremost a slowing of our processing speed. It takes us a little bit longer to process things. Our snap ability to move through something quickly is a little bit slower. That's a normal part of aging. Probably the second most common is the multitasking issue, I like to say. So whereas you used to be able to do 3 or 4 things in your brain at once, now you kind of find you have to just sort of do that first one and then move on to that second one. Maybe you can keep 2 things there at once, but you just can't multitask as rapidly as you used to. The third thing that's, again, normal with aging is forgetting names. So it isn't that you forget the person. You see a face, you recognize the face, but you just can't come up with their name. And naming is just one of those things we all have our moments with. The difference between everything I just said and dementia is a matter of degree. So if I forget Jim's name, but a few seconds later or a few minutes later, that's it, Jim. You know, that's typical of normal aging. Whereas with dementia, you may forget the name, and even after you've pondered on it, you still can't come up with the name. And then in worst case situations, even if you're told who Jim is, it still doesn't ring a bell with you. Now, that's obviously moving on into a form, a situation where there may be dementia. But the normal aging process, you forget a name and bingo, it's there a little while later. Or you can't multitask as fast, but you can still get everything done. You might write a list down, and when you have that list with you, you can get all those things accomplished without any difficulty. And just to put this into perspective, I often hear people come in and say, "Doc, I just can't quite remember the things I needed to do," or "I went to the store and I couldn't remember the five things that I thought I needed to pick up." And I'll say, "Well, what did you do when you were younger or before you retired with your work?" And they'd say, "You know, I have a list. I'd have my little list of chores and things and tasks." "Are you keeping your list?" And they'll say, "No, you got to keep your list." Because that's what your brain is hardwired to do. And now you're retired, of course, and you don't feel like you should have to do everything the way you did during your working years. But if you do those sorts of things, you know, you'll find that you can perform just as adequately. So that's just a few examples of sort of how to differentiate between normal aging and then maybe something that may be more than that.
And I guess what tools are used to diagnose it clearly, at you know, from your perspective at the clinic?
Well, and that's a great question, because one of the challenges is identifying these conditions early. And patients often don't like to bring this up. You know, they're anxious, or they're nervous, or they're embarrassed. And so when they come in for their regular checkup, the first task is getting them to tell you that they're having a problem. Often you'll hear it from a family member or somebody else. But then let's say you have that little tip-off. The question is, how do you accomplish in a 10 or 15-minute office visit, you know, amongst the other things that are there to be dealt with that day, a quick, simple way of analyzing this? And there are some quick little tools. Probably the one that I do the most in the office is what's called the animal fluency test. I ask somebody to tell me however many animals they can think of in 60 seconds. That's a quick, simple, very effective way of doing a screening for cognitive impairment or dementia. Animals are hardwired into our brain, and they're stored very vividly for many reasons. And if you can't pull out 15 or 16 animals in 60 seconds without repeating, there might be a problem. It doesn't automatically mean that there's a diagnosis, but it certainly raises a question. And the second thing I do is ask patients to draw a clock. I tell them, here's a piece of paper, draw a clock with all the numbers on the clock, and then put the hands at 10 minutes after 2. And just that little simple thing means that they have to executively understand what I just told them to do. They have to remember those several little things I just told them to do, and then they have to draw it. The act of drawing it takes a certain neurocognitive capability that sometimes, if there's a problem, they can't do. Two quick tests that I'll do in the office that I think any clinician can do, and if there is a problem there, then we move on to more detailed testing. And in the memory diagnostic clinic that we were referring to a minute ago, we have a psychologist then who will put a patient through a 40-minute or a 45-minute battery of questions that are picking up where we left off with the two that I just mentioned, but going into much more detail and depth, trying to probe for problems not only in memory, but also in some of those other cognitive categories that I was mentioning earlier, task, ability to do a task, or ability to connect dots, ability to do some mathematics in one's brain, asking questions about judgment issues, and maybe abstract thinking. So you go through that process, and it takes you further down the path of diagnosis and trying to identify if there's a problem.
Okay, let's say there's something comes up that looks suspicious, let's say. And, of course, we're on a scale, I'm assuming, in dementia from one end to the other as far as Alzheimer's. How do you start treatment? How do you go about working on treatment?
Well, and you know, so once you've gone through these tests and you've identified that there's enough information to diagnose a dementia, and again, 70% of the time it's going to be Alzheimer's type dementia, But whether it's that or the others, now the next step is what to do. And I think probably the most important point here is that the medications that are available are not a panacea. They are available. They can sometimes help reduce or the progression of the disease, but in most instances, they don't have a dramatic effect. And I want to make that statement so that people understand that. However, the benefit of early diagnosis is for all the other reasons more than just the treatment. The treatment issues are still important because many of us in the field feel that the reason the medicines don't work very well is because they're being given too late. The horse is out of the barn. The diagnosis has come too late. And that if we can identify people 10 years earlier, now how do we do that? Because they might be okay at that point, not really be having any symptoms. But if you can identify this disease in a pre-symptomatic state, and there's a lot, that's where all the research is going right now, identifying whether it's by genetic testing or other testing, that this is somebody at high risk, now you do the medications. Many feel that if it's handled in that fashion, you will in fact see a delay in the progression of the disease. So the early diagnosis has to do with being able to know that in the future we can implement some of these strategies. But more importantly than all of that is helping the family recognize what's going on, begin to lay the groundwork for the sorts of things that are going to be necessary, the caregiver issues, the best location to handle these problems, giving the spouse or the family members the necessary tools to be able to manage this condition, and then move down the pathway of the social and psychological and some, in many instances, financial issues that need to be addressed and dealt with. Progression is hard to judge ahead of time. With Alzheimer's disease, it's usually gradual over a period of years, but in other forms of dementia, it can be more quick or even more slow. But in any given individual, it's hard to know at first. So again, that's the part of getting them connected to the services and resources, the Alzheimer's Association, and what Julie and her team does is absolutely essential to families' abilities to be able to understand what to prepare for. And to know, besides just the memory loss and maybe some of the things I mentioned earlier, what are the other things that are going to happen? And how do you deal with them? What's the best way for you as a caregiver to address the memory loss or the behavior changes? Because when you have those tools, then it makes that whole process easier. So early diagnosis and moving on into treatment, whether it's the medications for what they can offer, but especially all the rest of the support systems for what they offer, is really what we try and accomplish.
That's Dr. Chris Keppel. You're listening to a forum here on WXPR concerning Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. We also have on our panel tonight Jim Brust. And Jim, you're here tonight as you were a caregiver. And I asked Julie when we were setting this up to find someone who had experienced this, because I think caregiving is, you just started to touch on that, Chris, when you were speaking. I think caregiving is a huge component of this. And I guess talk about how much, given as much as you're comfortable with, talk about your experience as a caregiver.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think the process I've noticed is that the caregivers often are in sometimes a more difficult position than the actual patient who has the disease, because then they're trying to go through all the things that Dr. Keppel just described. You know, what's the progression going to look like? What do I have to do about creating a safe environment? Things of that sort. You know, so my mom was diagnosed in a clinic similar to what Dr. Keppel had just described. And, you know, it was a very good experience from the perspective that at the end of it, at the end of the diagnosis, we knew what we were dealing with, where in the beginning you really didn't know. So we knew what the progression would look like. And, you know, some of the things that really I tried to do as a caregiver is create a safe environment. And, you know, my mom was living by herself at the time. She was driving at the time. And, you know, some of the things that kind of took us to go for the diagnosis was behavioral changes, significant behavioral changes. not being able to do a couple things at one time, completely forgetting to eat or forgetting to, you know, do hygiene kinds of things that, you know, typically that was just so unusual for her to do. You know, so that we then had the diagnosis, and then, you know, you had to go down then a path of making some decisions. And I think that when my mom was first diagnosed, she knew, and we had talked about it, she knew she was having issues. She knew she wasn't herself. And, you know, after the diagnosis, she, you know, thanked the team and said, now I know what's wrong with me. You know, where before she just really didn't understand, you know, why am I acting like this and why can't I remember this? And, you know, she was a really big baker and cook, and, you know, she couldn't do basic recipes that, you know, she could just do in her head. You know, typically she never, you know, looked at a piece of paper or anything. And that would, you know, she realized that she was going down that path. So then, you know, we had to make some decisions as far as, you know, stopping her from driving and taking things away from her or reducing things that cause stress. So I took over all of her finances and balancing her checking account and paying bills and things like that, because that was a very stressful time for her because she wasn't able to add numbers and to really kind of understand what you needed to do. You know, and it's interesting, before the diagnosis, she actually made a decision on her own to go out and buy a new car, and was managing her finances at the time and went out and bought a brand new car. And it was just like shocking to me that, you know, suddenly here she is with this brand new car, and you know, she had the capability financially to go buy it. But I realized that she was making some decisions that just weren't making a lot of sense at the time. You know, so as the disease progressed, we had to do various things. We eventually moved her out of her home. She had lived with me for like 18 months, and then the decision was made to put her into a community-based facility, actually here in Rhinelander, which was probably one of the best things we could have done. She loved it. You know, she at one point in time thought she was working there, and, you know, just they were just, it was just a fabulous environment to do that. And I think, you know, one of the things as a caregiver that you think about is that I'm really making the right decision. And I think other people will say, oh, you know, my God, I don't want to put my mother or father, whoever it is, into a nursing home or into a facility where they're being cared for. And I found that that was the right thing to do, you know, and trying to at least put her in an environment where she is safe and not disrupted by things. So I can remember this distinctly, that towards the end of her, you know, progression in the disease, I would always like to take her out to lunch like one or two times a week. And the person who was running the facility, you know, she said, are you doing that for you or for your mom? Because if you're doing it for you, that's one thing. But if you're doing it for her, it's disrupting her significantly. So, you know, the thought of having to get dressed and know that she was going to have to go out. And then, you know, she realized that she couldn't coordinate her, you know, silverware and the way she acted and things of that sort. And, you know, so I think a lot of times the decisions that you make, you have to make for the person, not necessarily for yourself and what's really, you know, what's right for them. But it's definitely a challenge. I mean, there's no question about it. And you know, what Dr. Keppel had mentioned, and Julie's here, you know, the work that is done in the memory clinic is just amazing. Not only had I experienced some of that, but one of my good friends just recently had her mother through the memory clinic, and she's a practicing nurse, and you know, she just was just shocked at the level of expertise that all come together to make a decision or a recommendation, not only on the treatment of the patient, but then how you're going to give support to the families as well. And the support for the families is significant. It really is.
One question I wanted to ask, how long did this whole process go for you?
Sure. It was probably about 6 months where I think all of us were somewhat in denial about, is this really happening or not? And then once we had the diagnosis, from the time she was diagnosed until she finally, you know, she did pass away from the disease, it was about 5 years, with varying degrees of, you know, severity in the disease.
Now, was it primarily on your shoulders, or did your family all help out, or how did it work?
Well, I'm an only child, so it really, okay, it was me and my partner, you know, creating the environment and taking care of her and things of that sort. And my mom was, you know, she was pretty proactive in understanding how important it was to have a financial power of attorney and a healthcare power of attorney. And, you know, that stuff was in place prior to her having to not be able to make the decisions herself, which to me was just an extremely important thing to have in place. because it's a lot more difficult to put some of that stuff in place when you don't have that cognitive ability than prior to that.
Okay. Again, a reminder, you're listening to a program on Alzheimer's here on WXPR. Julie, we haven't heard from you. And before we open it up a little more here, talk about the Alzheimer's Association. I think we're fortunate here in the Northwoods to have a chapter office right here in Rhinelander.
Yep, the Alzheimer's Association Greater Wisconsin chapter actually covers about the upper two-thirds of the state of Wisconsin, and we have numerous regional outreach offices across the state so that we can provide services to families on a more local level. And my office is here in Rhinelander.
What are some of the things you do offer?
Well, I think the biggest thing that the Alzheimer's Association does is information and referral. So oftentimes we get calls from family members who maybe are starting to see signs and symptoms that are concerning them and their with their loved ones, and they're wondering, you know, what's normal, what's not normal. How do we find out what's really going on? So a lot of times I spend my day answering those types of questions and then making referrals to services like the Memory Diagnostic Center. And with that, I just wanted to take a moment, too, when we talk about the importance of early diagnosis, this is something I stress really heavily for the families that contact me, because there's many things that can affect us as we age that mimic dementia. And sometimes those symptoms that we're seeing might have reversible and treatable causes. And so it's important for families, when they suspect that something is going on, to initiate that process of talking to their doctor or seeking a diagnosis for what's going on. I'm sure Dr. Keppel would attest to this, that we have people who have come into the Memory Diagnostic Center here in Rhinelander. We call them our worried well, where they have symptoms that they perceive to be troublesome, and when they go through the diagnostic process, we find out maybe it's something as simple as a medication side effect, or it could be something like depression that's interfering with their memory. And so a big part of what I do with the Alzheimer's Association is that education component about the warning signs and helping people access those diagnostic services. You know, the next step to that is when there is a diagnosis. I think it's important for families to understand that regardless of what type of dementia their loved one might be diagnosed with, it's more than just memory loss. It really globally affects that person's ability to care for themselves on a day-to-day basis. And so it's important for families to understand, you know, what steps they may need to take to assist their loved one. I recently had a young girl who contacted my office, and she said, you know, I knew that Alzheimer's disease meant that my dad was going to lose his memory, but I had no idea how it was going to affect everything else in his life. And, you know, I felt pretty privileged to be having that conversation with her and be able to answer her questions about how it was going to progress and some things that she could do to prepare and plan for the future as her dad's needs were escalating. So that information and referral is really important, helping families understand what the disease is, how it will affect them, and then also looking at what community resources are out there and how people might access those different kinds of resources. Some of the other things that we do here in the community, we have a number of family caregiver support groups, and I think that's really, really important. I am a big proponent for peer-to-peer support, and the support groups that we have in the area are facilitated by trained volunteers. Many of them have been caregivers at some point themselves, and so we refer families to these support groups where they can have a safe place to go and talk about the disease, how it's progressing, get helpful hints from other caregivers about how to handle situations when they come up. It's a safe place to go and cry when the going gets tough, and it's a safe place to go and laugh when sometimes that's your funny situations come up and you just have to be able to find the humor in those situations. We do community education programs. So we do a program called Know the 10 Signs, which has the goal of educating the community about what's normal and what's not normal with memory changes as we age. We do a Basics of Dementia program that educates the community about what Alzheimer's disease is, as well as some of the other related dementia and how it progresses. We do family caregiver classes in the community that if a loved one's been diagnosed, the families can come to the trainings, and we work with educating them about the disease, accessing services, how to cope with the caregiver stress issues that come up. So that's a big part of what I do here in the community.
Sounds like an enormous job.
It's an enormous job, but I feel, you know, privileged to have the job that I have. I feel privileged to be involved with the Memory Diagnostic Center and to be able to support families on this journey.
I imagine you work closely with them too, Chris, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I just can't stress enough how important it is for patients or their families. As Jim said, as they're beginning on this process, there's always that denial. Everybody has that. The patient has that. We all have that. And the families, it's like, you know, either I'm hoping this is going to get better. It's that little pain you have on the side. You hope it's going to get better. But here now is a problem with cognitive function. You're just hoping it's going to blow over and pass. Or many times, and this is true of patients, families, and clinicians, who all say, well, if we can't cure this, I've heard about dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and there's no cure. So what's the point of going in and doing tests if you can't fix it? And I hope that a lot of the things that the audience has heard tonight would be really key to understanding why it is important to get that early diagnosis. There may be reversible causes, and we can say in our memory clinic that we, you know, it's not just diagnosis of dementia and now preparing the family for the future. We have those success stories where somebody comes in and, my goodness, it turned out to be really bad depression, and they are better. They are cured after treatment. Or if it's the worried well, we can at least say to them, look, you're fine. You've had this detailed testing done. And because of the time we spend with them, they feel better. And just being able to feel better about it, you know, makes them capable then of moving forward and not getting stuck because they're thinking every little symptom may be the first clue of dementia. But having that access to what Julie and her team does and helping the caregivers and the families prepare for the future is absolutely the key to being able to deal with this journey effectively.
You just struck a point that really hit me as a physician. You know, if somebody comes in with a cut on their arm, you can pretty well diagnose what it is and fix it right away. But you might see someone who maybe exhibits some signs, but it may not be related at all and could be, as you mentioned, reversible. Does that make it difficult? I mean, how difficult is that?
That's very. I mean, it's a real challenge, especially in the typical medical model, which is the 15 to 20 minute office visit. And in fact, the majority of the time, I would say that the diagnosis of this disease is based upon those little clues that we pick up, not necessarily the patient coming in and saying, I'm here because I'm forgetting things and I think I have dementia. I mean, there are a few, and there's more like that than there used to be, and we're grateful for that because that's the education that Julie and her team does, and even people like Jim who have been caregivers and have gone through this and talk amongst them, their friends and people, and say, you should get in and get that check. So when they come in, we definitely deal with it. But a lot of times, patients are there for other reasons, their diabetes or their high blood pressure, and they don't say anything, and you're picking up on that subtle little cue. Uh-oh, something just wasn't quite right there, or that was an odd statement, or you find out that they were in a little accident with their car, and it's like, you know, that takes on a different meaning, you know, when they're 82 than it might have if they were 60. You have to follow those little clues. And the difficulty of it is not only picking up on the clues, but trying to do it in a way that's respectful to the patient and makes them feel that you care about them rather than that you're trying to uncover a difficult territory that they're already nervous and anxious about. Maybe they're not even aware of, and they get very resistant. Denial, a big problem that's very hard to break through. So education is very important.
One of the things I wanted to touch on is the scope of it, because I know there's a lot of people in this area who are over 50 years old. It seems to be a magnet. People like to retire here and so on. What are we looking at in terms of population up here who may be affected?
Well, there's more than 110,000 people in Wisconsin that have Alzheimer's disease. And in Oneida County specifically, we have about 1,100 people with Alzheimer's disease. And we know that that number is expected to grow. The baby boom generation just hit 65 last year, the age at which you're at greatest risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. So we know we have this baby boom generation, this wave of people now that are increasing in age and are at higher risk. And the demographics of the area that we live here in the North Woods, we do see the influx of people who come up here to retire. And we see, you know, the exodus of younger people out of the area as they look for, you know, different jobs and better wages, things like that. So I think that living in the North Woods presents some unique challenges for caring for people who have Alzheimer's disease. And that's part, again, of why that early diagnosis is important, because people really need to begin that process of planning for the future as the needs are going to increase, where they're going to find those services to assist them.
Okay.
The numbers, you know, another comment, you started out by saying 5 million people in this country with Alzheimer's disease, which is true, the prevalence of the disease. It's going to be 25 million in 2050 or more. And I think right now they say there's 25 or 30 million in the world with Alzheimer's disease. I'm sure there's a lot more than that, but that's kind of the number that's thrown out. So in 2050, we're going to have as many people in this country with Alzheimer's disease as we have in the world with Alzheimer's disease right now, based upon how population growth is going. And the number of new cases is going to continue to escalate, because it is a disease of aging, and we're all living longer. And so technology is allowing us to live longer. We're better at treating heart disease and better at preventing strokes, the two leading causes of death right now. But I think Alzheimer's disease was the seventh or eighth cause of death or is now considered. And it's going to be the second leading cause of death by 2050, based upon how all these numbers are converging. And so that's a public health crisis. When you think about other conditions like infectious diseases, you know, or influenza pandemic that might occur, we have what's developing here, an epidemic of dementia, and in particular Alzheimer's disease, that is emerging because of the aging of the population. And I don't know how we are going to be prepared, you know, financially and in terms of resources to be able to handle that. And so, you know, will this, you know, bankrupt our healthcare system and Medicare as we know it? Even now, we are being told that Medicare is going to be bankrupt by 2020 or 2025 for any number of other reasons, and now you add this on top. So it's going to be a real challenge trying to figure out how to manage this disease. But thus all the real important efforts at research, because the ability to treat this disease effectively, I think we are going to see something happen. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but there is tons of research being done. And I think that, you know, I always use with my patients who have dementia the example of cancer. If you go back 20 or 30 years ago, many cancers were incurable or only partially so. We have chemo. We have treatments now that can cure certain cancers that you couldn't cure before. So hang in there. Come along for the ride. Let's make the diagnosis and let's see what we can do, because there will be breakthroughs and there will be treatments.
Jim, it's also Caregiver Month, and I guess I'd like to have you take a moment and maybe give some tips that you would give to somebody who might have a family member who might be in this, you know, from your own experience. What would you suggest?
Well, probably the first thing I would suggest is to go to your doctor to get a diagnosis and to spend time with that doctor explaining the situation. And if you're not comfortable with that particular medical professional, then you need to find someone you're comfortable with who knows the disease and is willing to work with you to make the diagnosis. You know, because I think you alluded a little bit before that, you know, if there's not a lot of treatment, then why go through the process? You go through the process to make that person's life more comfortable as they continue to live it. So, for example, we did various things with my mother that really just changed her symptoms. So by getting her in a point where she had, you know, very good nutrition, as opposed to where she wasn't eating at all, her symptoms were much more improved by having that nutrition level in place and having a regular routine. So I think being able to do that, I think Julie mentioned about having other people to talk to. That's huge. You know, it's always good to be able to commiserate with other folks and kind of understand what they've been through. And, you know, there is a lot of crying, but there's a lot of laughing that has to go on, too. You have to have a sense of humor with the disease, because there are some pretty interesting and funny things that do happen. but I think it's important to have someone you can talk to about that. And, you know, with the self-diagnosis on the internet and things like that, I don't necessarily recommend that. But just doing research and looking at, blogs and what people are saying about, you know, things that have worked for them. I just think it's really important to kind of have that whole holistic look at it, to get the medical diagnosis and then look at the environment the person's in, create the things just to create a better environment so the person has a better life.
And you mentioned a point there about self-diagnosis. I guess the internet is a fabulous tool, but you're best to get to a doctor or someone who is a professional in this, correct?
Absolutely. Certainly need to get to a professional for that. But I think sometimes being able to be educated up front and reading books and things of that sort about, you know, what are some of the symptoms and what are some of my alternatives, so that, you know, you go in prepared, so that, you know, you're in that 15-20 minute discussion, you know, you're knowing the right questions to ask.
And you were saying, too, that you kind of had other people you bounce things off of, had some fun once in a while, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have at the time I had several friends who were going through similar things. And, you know, we would compare stories about, you know, things that my mother was doing that, you know, my God, if she ever knew that she was doing these things, it would just be, you know, just crazy stuff. And so, yeah, it was really good to do that. And I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, the Alzheimer's Association is funded by donations. And there are a lot of events like the Walk to End Alzheimer's and other events in the local communities that are great to get involved in for two reasons. One, you have the ability to raise money for the cause. But you also meet a lot of people, too, both from a medical perspective, from a caregiver side, as well as just other people who are going through the same thing. Mm-hmm.
That brings up a good point, Julie. You money is critical to the Alzheimer's Association. And talk about the walks and so on. Do go on.
Well, we have the Walk to End Alzheimer's that happens each fall. It's a national event, but we do have one that takes place here in Rhinelander. And actually, we're just wrapping up our Walk to End Alzheimer's season this year. This is a great opportunity to say thank you to the whole Northwoods community for helping us to achieve a record event this year with the Walk to End Alzheimer's. We've been fortunate to raise more than $49,000 in the fight against Alzheimer's disease. We had a record number of teams, and over 300 people came out to walk with us. And for me, you know, the funds are clearly critical in the fight against Alzheimer's disease, but I think another critical benefit of the Walk to End Alzheimer's is the degree to which it raises awareness of Alzheimer's disease in the community. When people see the articles in the newspaper about the event coming up, when they see the posters in the community, and when they're talking to other people, they realize, wow, the Alzheimer's Association is here. I didn't realize they were here. I need to get some help. I've got some questions. So for us, it's a critical fundraiser, but it's also a great way to raise awareness that the Alzheimer's Association is here. And we are a private nonprofit organization, and so we depend upon the donations and the generosity of the community to be able to support the work that we do. And those dollars are essential for us to be here in the Northwoods providing services. But I also would like to let people know that the Alzheimer's Association is actually the largest private funder of Alzheimer's disease research in the country as well. So a portion of the funds that we raise through our Walk to End Alzheimer's go towards finding a cure for the disease, or at least better treatments. And the type of research that the Alzheimer's Disease funds is really innovative researchers. We look for people that have new ideas, fresh ideas, that are thinking outside of the box and looking at a different direction towards achieving a world without Alzheimer's.
And the walk isn't just here in Rhinelander. You have walks in other places, too, as I recall. They happen during the fall, correct?
Yep. Typically during September and October. Some of them happen in November. Most of them in Wisconsin are actually in September and October. Here in the Northwoods, the closest ones we have, obviously, is the Northwoods Walk to End Alzheimer's that happens in Rhinelander, but there's also a walk in Anago. There's a walk in Phillips. There's a walk that happens in Wausau also. So, but we have 31 walks in the greater Wisconsin chapter, which out of all the chapters of the Alzheimer's Association in the country, we have the most walks walks to end Alzheimer's.
That's interesting. You mentioned that it's the main tool for raising money for research. So in other words, there isn't a big pot of money that just falls out of the sky for this.
Well, we're the Alzheimer's Association's the largest private funder. So certainly there are also other funding sources through, you know, the National Institute on Aging and things like that that fund Alzheimer's research. But we really do believe that we need to find a cure for this disease, and that's part of the goal of the Alzheimer's Association. That's really ultimately our vision is a world without Alzheimer's, and we can't do that without research. And with that, I would like to maybe put in a little plug for research. I think if you were to ask anyone in the community what they think the biggest barrier towards Alzheimer's disease research is, and they would probably say money. And that's probably true to a certain degree. But another barrier to Alzheimer's disease research is having people to participate in those research studies. There are Alzheimer's disease research studies out there right now that have funding that can't move forward because they don't have the people to study. They don't have the participants. And so...
So they're looking for people off the street, in essence, to help, right?
Exactly. And when you say people off the street, that's exactly what they're looking for. They're looking for not only people who have Alzheimer's disease, they're not just looking for people who have a family history. They're looking for people who are healthy volunteers that maybe don't have any family history at all, and all different ages. So if people are interested in learning more about how to get involved in Alzheimer's disease research, a great way that they could get connected to that is through the Alzheimer's Association. And we have a website, which is really easy to remember. It's alz.org. But if you were to go to our website, there's just a wealth of information for the public, for family caregivers, information to help them, but also information about how to get involved with research, which is through the Alzheimer's Association's Trial Match Program.
And research is what you had alluded to, some of it, and you say that the research is focusing in on drugs. Are these things short-term? Are they long-term? How long before you might see something?
Both short-term and long-term. Most of the studies are going to take probably somewhere between 3 and 7 years to be able to generate adequate information. One of the big ways of getting more information quicker is to do trials in a variety of locations around the country and then pool those results together. That allows the ability to get information more quickly. But I did want to say one quick thing. So Julie is talking about the private funding for Alzheimer's coming through Alzheimer's Association. The public funding largely comes through the federal government. UW in Madison, as I've alluded to a few times, is one of the institutions that has been able to obtain some of the higher levels of funding from the federal government. And they have a variety of studies. Julie is aware of some of those through the Alzheimer's Association. And I will say that while we're looking for people to be involved in studies, Rhinelander in our greater Rhinelander area has participated already. We have 4 or 5 people who are involved in clinical trials at UW, one of which is called RAP, which stands for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, which is looking at children of patients with Alzheimer's disease. And trying to identify the mean. I think right now they have over 1,000 people enrolled from Wisconsin, a mean age of around 58 or 59 years old, and none of them have the disease yet, but some are probably going to develop it. So what is it about them in the early stages? And so they're involved in this research activity. We have people from our area involved. So this is an example of where you can palpably be immediately involved in research that's going on in our community or in our state that's going to lend information to helping with earlier diagnosis and treatment. So there's a lot happening out there that people can be involved in if they so choose to.
It strikes me, it's a little bit like how cancer, at first they said there was, you know, it was difficult, there was nothing that really worked, and then slowly you're seeing, very slowly, but you're seeing progress each and every year. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Okay. We have just about 10 minutes left. You're listening to a program on Alzheimer's here in the preventions and some of the treatments and some of the services that are offered here on WXPR. I'm your host, Ken Kroll, with Julie St. Pierre from the Greater Alzheimer's Association Greater Wisconsin Chapter, Dr. Chris Keppel from Northern Wisconsin Memory Diagnostic Center, and Jim Brust, who is with us today as a caregiver. I guess in the final few minutes, I'd like each of you to take a couple of minutes and tell us what do you think people should do? You know, what is your advice? I guess if you have to give somebody advice, if they're thinking, you know, what should they do?
Well, as a caregiver, I think they need to proactively help the person who they think has an issue and get them to be diagnosed in a medical facility that specializes in that or by their family practitioner. I think that's extremely important. That's a place to start because that then will get rid of some of the doubts in which you have. I also think that what Julie was mentioning about Trial Match, you know, I just recently signed up for that. So I went onto the website, I put in my statistical information as a son of someone who had the disease, and that immediately came back to me with information about how I can get involved in the research. So that's something I can do that I, you know, that can help. I just think it's extremely important to, you know, just to help other people who have it as well, who are also caregivers, and to, you know, have that support mechanism for them.
Okay. And Julie, what you know, if somebody is hearing this, and what would be your advice?
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago I did another interview, and the person who was interviewing me asked me, "What's the most frustrating part of your job?" And it ties into, you know, what you're asking me here. The most frustrating thing is when I encounter a family after the fact, after they've walked the journey of Alzheimer's and they've lost their loved one, and they say to me, "Well, where were you when I was taking care of my mom?" And, you know, that literally breaks my heart, because nobody should have to go through the journey of Alzheimer's disease by themselves. There's far too many supports and services out there for people who are affected for anyone to have to go through it alone. And so, you know, my advice to family caregivers or people who are affected is don't be afraid to get that diagnosis. Don't be afraid to seek out those supports and services, because there are a lot of people out there in the community who want to be there to help and support you. So don't be afraid to ask for that help and seek out that support, because no one should go through it alone.
Brings up a point. I imagine you've all kind of run into people who maybe they have a family member who has the problem and they don't want to, they're not ashamed, but shy to come forward with it. Have you experienced that?
I think there still is a stigma that's associated with any type of memory loss. We're starting to get better about it. Having conversations like that we're having tonight definitely are part of the process of erasing that stigma. Because I think even 15, 20 years ago, having this much time devoted on a radio station to Alzheimer's disease would be unheard of. So this is an example of the hurdle that we're overcoming.
I have to tell you, in my own experience, it was probably about that long ago when I first heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a person who should be in the know.
Right.
You know, it took a while before it bubbled up, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. because I think it was always put in the context of something else, right?
I think so. I think a lot of times, anytime there were memory difficulties, people would just attribute that to being a normal part of getting older. And now we know that Alzheimer's disease is not a normal part of getting older.
Explain that.
Well, we know, you know, memory changes, as Dr. Keppel alluded to. He explained some of those memory changes, those subtle things that people experience as they age. But those changes don't interfere with their ability to take care of themselves on a day-to-day basis the way that Alzheimer's disease does. And so we know that Alzheimer's disease is a disease process. People can't control getting the disease, and they can't control the symptoms and how they progress. So people need to understand that it's a disease, just as cancer is a disease, and we need to, you know, take steps to help those people who are affected.
And Chris, what would be your advice?
Well, I would say break down the barriers. For patients and families not to be afraid to come forward, as Jim said a minute ago, not to be afraid to ask for help, not to be afraid to understand that even though there might not be a cure, that there is much that can be done to make that journey more effective for them. We are blessed, I think, to live in the North Woods. The North Woods offers lots of wonderful things to us. And I found over the almost 30 years that I've been here as a physician that one of the things that our area allows is for the community to come together to take care of one another. it is possible to do that when you have an environment that has people live close to one another that care about one another. And as Julie alluded to, the medical system can only do so much. It is all these other resources, these support groups that Jim has been involved in, the associations and all the things that they can provide for patients and their families to allow them to understand what's happening, what's going to happen, and to be able to make that journey in a way that is as unburdensome for them as it can be. It is going to be a burden, but it's a part of life at that point. And so we need to be prepared. I think the other thing is for people at this point, so, you know, understanding and recognizing that one of the things that happens with dementia and Alzheimer's disease in particular is once you get it, your perspective about yourself changes. You don't often recognize that what you have is a problem. You pass off things that that are significant concerns as being minor. You still want to drive, for example, when that might be a danger. And so if you recognize early on enough in your life that, you know, there may come a time when I may have this condition, and so I want to prepare now for it. I want to say to have the dialogue with your family that if this occurs, help me get help, okay, and help me understand the things that I need to do. And if I shouldn't be driving, then let's have a plan in place now for how we're going to deal with that when we go forward. Because if we don't prepare for these sort of things ahead of time, they become crisis situations when they occur, and they put a great burden on the family. So recognize ahead of time that this is something that we have to think about as we go forward. Have the discussion with your family. Know who your friends and neighbors are, because they want to help. They want to help when it comes to this sort of thing. And know that we have one of the most outstanding Alzheimer's associations here available that has all these resources. I think if you can have that information available, know it's there, you can prepare.
Sounds a little bit like what the lawyers have been saying for years about getting prepared with a will. You have to have almost the same kind of approach. Well, you know, our time has just about drawn to a close. So we appreciate all of you for coming in today. We hope, you know, you've learned more about Alzheimer's disease during this program here on WXPR. Again, some of the resources include the Alzheimer's Association here in Rhinelander and the Dr. Chris Keppel at the Northern Wisconsin Memory Diagnostic Center, Julie St. Pierre, of course, the outreach specialist for the chapter here. And I also want to give special thanks to our caregiver, Jim Brustu, who joined us on the panel today. A lot of great things you shared with the audience today. So if you have any questions, contact one of the people we just mentioned. And this is Ken Kroll, and thank you for listening.